So here's a lyric that caught my eye for that song. When your lover's in a dangerous time, sometimes you're made to feel as if your love is a crime. But nothing worth having comes without some kind of a fight. And the best line, you've got to kick at the darkness until it bleeds daylight. It's good, isn't it? So Bruce Cockburn, who is a Canadian artist and way less recognized, but way more of a musician than, say, Miley Cyrus, wrote that song after watching his daughter steal her first kiss on the playground. And it was the late 1980s, and the Cold War was at its height. And so he had his daughter and this teenage boy that they were kissing, and the rest of us in mind, lovers in a dangerous time when the whole world was at such risk. And you could say that the time has been eased, that this fear has been eased, and the danger of I don't know, nuclear war has been limited. Maybe just changed is more accurate. But it's also still true that the threat, that the danger that we experience of being lovers in a dangerous time is still there. There's, you know, there's too much bad news that overwhelms us. Violence in the world seems to overwhelm us. The mantra of the news, if it bleeds, it leads, still seems to always win out. Environmental threat hangs over us. And then, of course, there's religion, which is supposed to be a force of good in the world, but so often it is not, which leads many of us to conclude, wrongly, I think, that all religion does is tear us apart. So you could say that you and I, and this church, really, is a lover in a dangerous time. So in this spirit of being lovers in a dangerous time, I offer these top 10 religious news stories of 2013, a practice that I borrowed from my mentor, Roger Payne, who is retiring after this year from Lincoln, and one that I've done every year that I've been with you. A reminder as I do so that mine is a free pulpit and yours is a free pew, which means that I get to speak my mind and my heart and my spirit, and you get to disagree with me. So deep breath in and deep breath out, and let us meet together. Number 10, Malala. So say her name with me, Malala. Malala is a young Pakistani girl, she's 16 years old, who you may remember in 2009, when she was just 11, wrote a blog for BBC News that challenged the Taliban prohibitions against girls receiving an education. Remember her? And she survived an attempt on her life for writing that blog. After she healed from bullet wounds to her neck and to her head, Malala gave a powerhouse talk to the United Nations. You can watch it on YouTube. I encourage you to do so. And gave a great interview on Jon Stewart and became the youngest person ever and the first girl ever to receive a nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize. Said Malala, Islam says that it is only each child's right to get education. It's also their duty and their responsibility. The Taliban think that we are not Muslims, but we are, because we believe in God more than they do. And we trust God to protect us. Is Malala a lover in a dangerous time? Is she kicking into the darkness until it bleeds daylight? She is one of the most important voices in Islam today. And she offers a needed corrective, I think, against all those who, citing the Taliban, say religion is up to no good in the world. This is what people tell me when I tell them I'm a minister. Religion's horrible. Look at the Taliban. Look at all these stories. And have given up on it. Malala is the one who's being religious here, okay? Okay? Spread the word. Number 9. falls from grace while good cracks spread in the stained glass ceiling. Now, part of the reason the people kind of, they look at me like this, like when I tell my minister, they kind of look at me like sideways in this wary glance. And part of the reason some people come to church pre-offended. They do. Kind of like this, you know? Is because of bad actors like the now retired Cardinal Roger Mahoney and Yeshiva University President Rabbi Norman Lamb, who are both accused this year of inadequately responding to clergy sex abuse scandals, with Mahoney being stripped of his duties but not his vote at the papal conclave, and Yeshiva facing a $380 million lawsuit. Meanwhile, only just yesterday, up till this sermon, so it's still 2013 for me until this sermon, yesterday, Monsignor William Lind was released from prison, where he'd been housed for 18 months after being charged with child endangerment for reassigning sexually abusive priests to other parishes instead of reporting them to the police. Remember him? The sordid revelations, the indifference of religious leaders to crime, the devastation of victims' lives, and damaged integrity to religious institutions are the fall from grace part. It's kind of old news, right? So rejoice with me over the cracks that kind of spread in the stained glass ceiling. The stained glass ceiling, by the way, is meant to describe the inequity between women and men in professional ministry. Crack number one, the Church of England voted to approve the appointment of women bishops. Crack number two, the Regional Conference of Seventh-day Adventists elected its first female district president. Crack number three, Reverend Elizabeth Eaton was elected presiding bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And continuing crack number four, the UUA, the Unitarian Universalist Association, continues to be one of the few major denominations where women are the majority of our clergy. This has been true since 1999. Interesting side fact. Only this year, after being a teaching congregation for, what, like 6 years now? Only this year have we received our first male applicant. We've never received any guys at all before. We also have one male applicant for the assistant minister position, which might mean that after a dearth of men considering ministry for a career, some guys are showing interest. In my opinion, large majorities either way are not healthy for our ministry, and they're not healthy for you. They're not. Both women and men, boys and girls, need to see people like them as religious leaders, which is also an argument for welcoming more LGBT people into our ministry and hiring them in our congregations. We may be a small movement, but let us continue to be on the leading edge of this important work. And remember that being right will not always make us popular. So my son asked me this morning that this is the one sermon that he comes and he loves to sit in. He said, "Will there be any funny ones?" I don't know if this is funny, but we'll see. Number eight, Satan in the square. Now, I'll resist giving you the sermon I have yet to give about Satan and hell, which until Dante's Inferno wasn't so much a person or a place as it was a condition of life. Satan, I'm going to do some etymology here for us. Satan, referring to the Hebrew word satan, which means to interrupt or block someone's path. So who among us has not experienced interruptions in life before? Kind of makes the question, are you saved from Satan, a little bit more complicated to answer, doesn't it? And anyway, because we live in a religiously diverse country, and there are people who not only experience such interruptions, but apparently are prepared to worship them, These folks, and my favorite story of irony this year, showed up in Oklahoma, determined to put their own statue next to the Ten Commandments monument outside the State House. I'm wondering, did it block the State House, the Ten Commandments? Did it interrupt the Ten Commandments? Said Lucian Graves of the New York-based Satanic Temple, because if you're a Satanist, you need to be named Lucian. This is what he said. We believe that all monuments should be in good taste and consistent with community standards. Our proposed monument, as a homage to the historic and literary Satan, will certainly abide by these guidelines. This sounds reasonable, right? My favorite part. Lucian also said, one potential design features a pentagram, which is a symbol for Satanism, while another is meant to be an interactive display for children. Now is a good time to remind you that I'm not making any of these stories up. Interactive display for children. Emerson, is this funny? A little bit, okay. So if this happens, promise that we will have a church field trip to Oklahoma City. And bringing with me will be design plans for a child-friendly interactive chalice. With the flame, it gets higher every time someone affirms separation of church and state, which is a principle put in place, by the way, by our founders, Unitarians, to protect the state, to protect religion from the state and not the other way around, which is what most people assume. Okay, number 7. Jesus, Santa, a Muslim, and Fox News walk into a bar. Was Jesus white? Was Santa white, for that matter, too? And can a Muslim write about Jesus? Can he write a book about Jesus? Is that allowed? So if you're Fox News in 2013, the answers to these questions are yes, yes, and no, in that order. So in December, Fox News host Megyn Kelly made herself the center of a racial controversy by declaring that Santa Claus and Jesus Christ are, in fact, Caucasian. Kelly made the claim when she was responding to a recent article in Slate discussing the racial identity of Santa, whose exact description, by the way, just for the record, can be left to individual interpretation. We've all watched Disney movies, have we not? There are many depictions. However, after a guest on her show defended the article, Kelly extended her argument to claim that the historical figure of Jesus was in fact a white person, saying, just like Santa, Jesus was a white man too. Into the camera. You can watch this on YouTube. Earlier in the year, Fox News religion correspondent Laura Green found herself interviewing Reza Aslan about his new book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, which explore the historical Jesus. She set the tone with the first question. She said to him, now Reza, you're a Muslim, so why did you write a book about the founder of Christianity? After the interview, which continues the whole time in all of its awkwardness, and again can be seen on YouTube, Aslan's book shot to the top of the bestseller list on Amazon.com and New York Times. He said afterwards, every time that I write a book, I know the first place I'm going to go is Fox News. All of this proves that Jesus, that word, that name, continues to be such a tender spot for our culture and for you. And for you. Indeed, after our choir's performance of Handel's Messiah on that snowy day in December, that icy day, several folks in the receiving line came up to me and wondered how all this talk of Jesus in our church would affect all of us, including especially their Jewish friends who were here to listen to the music. I don't know how to be more clear about how we speak when we speak of Jesus, except I will say again, Jesus was a Jew and not a Christian. He sought to reform the Judaism of the day and not to invent a new religion, which happened later, after he died. As Unitarian Universalists, he is for us some more, some less, a teacher whose moral example and lessons have much to teach us. Who asked 200 questions Jesus did in the Bible and answered only 8 of them. Asked 200 and answered only 8. Which challenges the Jesus tells me so quip a great deal, I think. So I will use my pulpit freedom to say that conservative Christians don't get to keep Jesus to themselves, all for themselves, any more than we get to keep Ralph Waldo Emerson to ourselves. So why can't we kick at the darkness a little bit and help us expand what I experience as limited thinking that says only Christians get to talk about Jesus and not Muslims, which we laugh about, but also not Unitarian Universalists either. I just don't get it. And you can see it gets me exercised. I just don't get it. And as the question, was Jesus white or not, I will quote Globe columnist and former priest James Carroll, who in a December 30th Globe editorial replied, "Wrong question. The whole debate," he says, "shows much more readily how one's unexamined assumptions," we have ours too, "can distort historical fact about great figures in history. And as a born and raised Middle Eastern man, Jesus was not white. He was a circumcised Jewish Middle Eastern man." But then James says, "Neither is God. God is not white either," he says. Number 6. Rest in peace. 2013 saw us lose some of the greats, and towering over all of them was Nelson Mandela, who at 95 was remembered after his death as a modern-day Moses who led his people out of racial captivity. But he was also less well-known for encouraging, when he was younger, the violent overthrow of the apartheid regime, leading Reagan and Thatcher and other conservatives in the 80s to brand him a terrorist at the time. Other lives lost, Robert Bella, the academically famous sociologist whose book Habits of the Heart charted how religion contributes a little bit and mostly detracts, he said, from American society. And of course, we lost St. Louis baseball great Stan Musial, whose framed picture in my Catholic high school, his alma mater, was larger than any picture of Jesus in the entire school. It was huge. It was like 12 feet by 6 feet. And resting in peace, we pray, but also having new life, as the memory of MLK's I Have a Dream speech on the Mall, which was 50 years ago, this year in 2013, as well as the 150th anniversary of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address that paved the way for MLK and so many others with these opening lines. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. And we might add, as a postscript now in this time, all women, everybody, everybody. Number 5, we're at 15 and 16 and 17 and 18, no thanks to Phil Robertson. And hey, Sochi, here we come. So this year saw gay marriage continue to make inroads into the states, including Hawaii, which was 15, Illinois, which was 16, Utah, which is still in the balance, number 18, and 17 is in maybe California. And Massachusetts, of course, celebrating 10 years of gay marriage allowed in the state, which means that I get to go to many, hopefully, anniversary parties for the weddings that I officiated in 2004. All of this, no thanks to Phil Robertson. Do we know who he is? He is the patriarch on cable television's most popular show. Most popular. Duck Dynasty, which is all about this family that's made millions from making these little duck calls. So in December, which is a very busy month for my list, Phil made a series of anti-gay bigoted statements in a GQ interview based on his personal interpretations of the Bible. The article went viral, along with his biblical interpretations, which caused many to respond that the same book of Leviticus from which he was drawing his comments about gays also says that you should not have any, like, really, really long hair and beards, okay? So if you don't know, Robertson looks like an angry version of Willie Nelson. Or Don, maybe, actually, if he's over there. But Don wears a shirt for the, you know, that says tree huggers. Don's like the nice Duck Dynasty guy. This guy looks mad. He just looks mad all the time. But look, if you're prepared to denounce Phil and to denounce the show, you at least have to watch it to know what it is you're denouncing. You at least have to see. Because the show can be charming and it can be funny, which makes his anti-gay statements in the channel A&E's on again, off again, I think now he's back on the show, it makes it much more complicated and it makes our response more needed. What do we say about this guy? His biblical interpretations are the reason that people say, I don't read the Bible, it's a bigoted book. But you're not reading the Bible closely enough, and neither is Phil. Both of us have the same problem. We're not looking at this text deeply enough to understand the complexity of it. Meanwhile, Sochi, as in the location of the upcoming Winter Olympics, as in Russia, the country that passed strict anti-gay propaganda in 2013 and has faced international controversy ever since. Now, the best part to me of this whole story was President Obama's response, who in his place, for the first time since 2000 that neither President nor First Lady have gone to the Olympics, has said that he's going to send two lesbian athletes, retired tennis star Billie Jean King and female hockey player Caitlin Kahau. And he went on Jay Leno, I think in October, and said, I have no patience for countries that treat gays and lesbians or transgendered people in ways that intimidate them or harmful to them. Now, hearing him, I wish that he would have a sit down with the Methodist Church, who in one of the most heartbreaking stories of the year stripped the clerical credentials of Reverend Frank Schaefer for violating church law when he married his son at a same-sex wedding. The punishment by the church prosecutor, which is a phrase that has all kinds of problems on its own, was intended by church officials to intimidate others from replicating what Frank did. Instead, as is often the case where right meets might, the trial and defrocking have galvanized many Methodist ministers to step forward and disobey the church, including some from my alma mater, Boston University's School of Theology, which is a Methodist-affiliated seminary. Reverend Schaefer, I think he's probably going on now, but he spent the holidays with his son at his home in Hull, and he attended Christmas Eve services at the Methodist Church in that town, proving that if you have a problem with your church, you don't leave. You stay and you fix what's wrong. So I say, keep kicking at the dark, Frank, until it bleeds daylight. Number four, how we doing? It's 11:30, we have four more to go. This year I'm not giving out money to keep you here. Last year, for those of you who aren't here, I gave out money at the end just to keep you happy. Number four, can Obama care? So, and sheesh, right? If this year's healthcare stories proved anything, it is number one, do not hire outside help to create your website. Number two, in this tech age of everything tech, a dysfunctional website can nearly destroy an entire presidential administration. Number three, the president does not always tell us the truth or know enough to tell us the truth. As in, if you like your health care, you can keep it. He said that hundreds of times. Number four, what we've learned, the cost of many people's health insurance is going to increase, including some of you. And number five, Republicans will do anything to stop it from succeeding, including even reading Green Eggs and Ham from the Senate floor. And five, what we've learned about the healthcare this year is that all of these points matter, and they matter a lot. But they don't diminish for me how this is a religious issue and the way it involves spending public money to make sure that low-income folks and middle-income folks, including, by the way, some of my Missouri-based family, have health insurance. The fact that some lawmakers see this role for government as a bad thing is the same principle that has led the House to pass massive cuts for food stamps. The stance of defunding Obamacare, because it is flawed to me, lacks a little bit of logic. If the reform is so flawed, then why not try to make it better? Why not wait until the law takes full effect and its failures become obvious, at which point we can repeal the less destructive portions of it, rather than blow up the whole economy? I'm sure some of you disagree. Free pew. But as your minister, I do not understand the vitriol in the opposition. Doth protest too much. Meanwhile, as a testament to the complexity of the issue, last week Justice Sonia Sotomayor blocked a portion of the law that would have forced some religious affiliated organizations like Hobby Lobby to provide health insurance for employees that include birth control coverage. These inherently difficult issues only drive home Winston Churchill's point that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others that have been tried. Number three, I am in love with Barry Black. Who is Barry Black? Now, Barry is usually a calm, pastoral presence on Capitol Hill, doling out his spiritual wisdom and moral counsel to his high-powered, Dr. Seuss-loving flock. But the Seventh-day Adventist and former Navy Rear Admiral was mad as Dante's hell in October about the government shutdown, and he let the Senate and the God of many names know about it. So on October 1st, the first day of the shutdown, he prayed for divine guidance up in front of the senators to strengthen our weakness, replacing cynicism with faith and cowardice with courage. And then on October 3rd, 2 days later, he prayed, save us from the madness. We acknowledge our transgressions and our shortcomings, our smugness, our selfishness, and our pride. Deliver us from the hypocrisy of attempting to sound reasonable while being unreasonable. And then just the next day, because they keep coming back for more, the day after officers from the U.S. Capitol shot and killed a woman who had used her car, remember, to ram into the Capitol, Black noted that the officers were not being paid because of the government shutdown, the officers who were protecting the senators. And remarking that he was being unpaid too, he said, "I am being remunerated from above." And that's pretty special. On the fourth day of the shutdown, he also prayed regarding the senators, "Remove from them that stubborn pride which imagines itself to be above and beyond criticism. Forgive them the blunders they have committed." I'm thinking, you know, Stephanie prays a lot here. She is so nice to us compared to Barry Black. On day 9, prompted by news of the delay of death benefits for military families, Black prayed, "It is time for our lawmakers to say enough is enough. And I ask that God to cover our shame with the robe of your righteousness." And finally, on day 11, Black prayed to give our lawmakers the wisdom to distinguish between truth and error. Give them a hatred of all hypocrisy, deceit, and shame as they seek to replace them with gentleness and patience and truth. My favorite part is that the U.S. representatives, after hearing him pray day after day, invited him to deliver their invocation in the chamber in January. Keep kicking at the dark, Reverend Black. Number 2, terrorism at home and abroad. These headlines are what make my job so hard. The headline that says, religious inspired attacks claim scores of lives. Well, that's not my religion. It's not yours. Don't let these headlines tell you that you can't be a religious person. But anyway, religious inspired, said the headline, attacks claim scores of lives with extremist Buddhist monks fomenting attacks on Muslims, and Muslim extremists targeting Christians at churches in Egypt, in an upscale mall in Kenya, and a church in Pakistan. And then in the streets of London, British soldier Lee Rigby is killed by a self-proclaimed jihadist. And then in April, usually a cheerful month in New England with the first bloom of spring, as we all know, the sky darkened with clouds of ash and smoke as the Snarf brothers tried to bomb away our marathon, killing scores, injuring scores more, and creating one of the most surreal and shocked and tender and sad weeks for us since 9/11. I'll never forget preaching that following Sunday in Max's blue marathon jacket. Max, a member of our youth group before he went to college, who in running the race turned the corner onto Boylston Street right before the bombs went off and saw it happen. What to say but Boston strong. That tagline, I think, was by Emerson College students about this adopted city of ours. And about what Stephen Colbert said, they are so tough in Boston, they are so tough, that they shut down an entire city to catch the bad guys. A city so tough that it's founded by people, the pilgrims, who were so tough that they needed to buckle their hats on their heads. Again, you gotta watch this clip on what? On YouTube. And then Noam Chomsky, that oh-so-liberal MIT professor whose office is right above the corner where the young MIT professor Sean Collier was killed by the brothers before their capture that crazy day, wrote after the bombing these words, "It is rare for privileged Westerners to see graphically what many others experience every single day." And at the same time, this coming Wednesday, when Karen drives her parents to the airport to go back to England, she will drive on the Pike and look on the right, right by Fenway Park, and she will pass a billboard that gives the number of American deaths killed by guns. It's an approximate number since Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre. So on December 14th, the last time that I looked, the number read 32,833, which is roughly the size of a Newtown classroom every 3 days. And here's the amazing thing to me as your minister, who last year sought to take on this issue a little bit and hold a forum here in town. Since Newtown, many states have not strengthened their laws, but loosened them, making it easier, not harder, to buy a gun in many parts of the nation. Said Obama after Newtown, "Are we really prepared to say that we're powerless in the face of such carnage, that the politics are too hard?" And said Gabby Giffords, the former representative from Arizona, who herself was a victim of violence, and this year toured the country and went to gun shows all over. One word, she said, enough. We'll see. Which is maybe why that photo of 8-year-old Martin Richard, who died in the bombings, continues to hold such resonance for us. You remember what it said? What did it say? No more hurting people. No more hurting people. We made it to number one. My top story for 2013 is Pope Francis really a universalist? You were expecting it, right? Yeah. And you know, one has to wonder about him. Ever since Benedict's historic retirement, first pope to retire in 600 years, it's quite a list, 600 years, and Francis' nomination, the man born as Jorge Bergoglio, I'm pronouncing that wrong, I'm sure someone will tell me later on, but he has surprised and humbled and pleased and troubled Catholics all over the world, depending on your perspective. We should have known something was up when he chose Francis as his name after St. Francis of Assisi, who emphasized humility and social justice. No pope in history has chosen that name, ever, ever. The pope's first act, getting rid of the Pope Mobile and driving in a Fiat. I don't even drive a Fiat. The pope's second act, washing the feet of two female prisoners during a Maundy Thursday service, the first time a pope has ever done that for anyone except priests. He was just getting warmed up. Since then, Francis has downplayed the importance of such hot-button issues as abortion and contraception and gay marriage, describing the church as, quote, obsessed with small-minded rules. He is a universalist. And then he described the papal court and heads of the church, in my most favorite quote, as often a bunch of narcissists, flattered and thrilled by their courtiers. And as such, the court has become a leprosy of the papacy. I guess he's speaking his mind. And then in talking with an atheist journalist, he said simply, everyone has his or her idea of good and evil and must choose to follow the good and fight the evil as they conceive them. That would be enough to make the world a better place, would it not? He said. So how do I know, as your minister, that his leadership ushers a new way of folks to think and see and feel about religion? How do I know? Well, I know when the strongest atheists among you email me with links of praise to the Pope. It's just amazing to me, saying that maybe they are not as alone as they felt before in the world. That's how I know. And to end, my most favorite part of all of this, this story number one, and like the whole, I think all 10 actually, is the look on the face of the person who received from the Vatican the medal intended to mark the anniversary of the first full year of Pope Francis as head of the Catholic Church. The medals were made in bronze and in silver and in gold, and they were sealed by the Italian mint, and they were beautiful. So my favorite story is when the first person lifts the lid on the box. It's beautiful. What does that say? Wait, what does that say? These words, L-E-S-U-S, Christ. Top story is the misspelling on the coin. It said Lesus Christ instead of Jesus Christ. And so they had to recall all of the coins and make new ones. True story. And I heard about it, of course, on the favorite minister's research device, not YouTube, but wait, wait, don't tell me. So happy new year to each of you. Keep kicking at the dark until it bleeds daylight, and keep loving in dangerous times.